And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to Fantasy Feud, a pitcherless baseball podcast where we're tackling the most relevant debates in fantasy baseball each week. I'm Sarah Sanchez, and I'm here with my co-host, Shelley Verstrate, to talk through both sides of the hottest fantasy baseball debates right now. Y'all, it is a big week in fantasy baseball. The Korea Series kicks off tomorrow. I am so excited. It's main event weekend. I'm not going to Vegas. I'm just like having a ton of FOMO from afar, and I'm going to be following all the moves y'all are making. Shelley, are you getting up early tomorrow to watch baseball at 6 o'clock in the morning, or are you just going to catch the recap later?
Well, I'm usually up at like 5 in the morning. Well, my alarm goes off at 4:40. So I will be up. Whether my TV will be on, I don't know. Knowing that it's like the first game of the season, it probably will be on the TV when I'm, you know, checking my emails before I start my day. But yeah, I'm just like so excited for baseball is actually here. Main event. I have my first main event on Saturday. I'm doing it online. I'm not going to Vegas. But yeah, so it's just, I can't believe it. We actually made it.
We did. The long dark of winter has finally ended, except in Chicago, where winter will persist periodically because Chicago does Chicago things. We are joined by a guest who might also be doing some drafting this weekend, might also be setting his alarm for the Korea series. I'm pretty excited to have Eric Halterman on Fantasy Feud. You've heard him on MLB Network Radio, Sirius XM, and of course you've enjoyed his work at RotoWire. He is my league mate in GLARP and like low-key one of the funniest people I have ever met in my entire life. Eric, welcome to Fantasy Feud.
Thanks for having me on. That's a lot of pressure. I gotta now be really boring this whole show to throw off your intro there.
Eric, are you gonna be up early in the morning watching baseball live from Korea?
It'll depend on when I go to sleep. The start time is a lot closer to when I normally fall asleep than to when I normally wake up when all is going well. And, you know, I've got a draft tonight, so we'll see how long that goes. It's going to be hard to miss it, though. If I have any chance of being up, it's going to be hard to not be there when the rest of the world is watching. So I'm still not sure.
What are you drafting tonight?
I've got a NL-only keeper league, so this is nice to do an NL-only auction a few days after finishing the NL-only Tout Wars. I feel like I'm as prepared as I can be for that. Going into the draft with a bunch of totally acceptable $5 players, should have some money to play with, going to have some fun, I hope.
Oh, nice. That sounds like a fun time. I am on your side of this. I'm usually up at about 7:30 and begrudgingly so, because that's when I have to get up to be ready for work. And so I'm going to try to set my alarm and go to bed early tonight and do all the things I need to do to be up watching baseball at 5 a.m. I feel like if I am up watching baseball by 6 a.m. and I just like ignore social media for a while, that might also work. But 5 a.m. is real early in Chicago. I do love that they're starting the series in Korea, though. I thought the Dominican series was incredible. All of the international baseball initiatives are good, in my opinion.
Yes.
Totally.
We agree on that. So that's not what you're here for, because this is a debate fantasy baseball podcast. Just a reminder for those of you who might be joining us for the first time, rules of the road. We will be tracking time and everybody has a side in each of these debates. So you get 3 minutes to make your case, 3 minutes to make the opposite case. There's a question and answer period where the moderator or the debaters can ask each other questions for a couple of minutes after that. And then both of our debaters get a 1 minute rebuttal for their piece. This is going to be a fun one, y'all, because draft season is winding down and coming to its apex, as it were. It's like that peak weekend where a bunch of big drafts are happening. And there have been so many injuries, as we mentioned last week, that ADP is just all over the place. I think that it's impacted the way people are approaching the draft. I think it's impacting the way they're approaching their KDS before drafts. And so we're just going to start there. You're setting your KDS going into some of your biggest drafts or biggest home league drafts of the weekend. Where do you want to be drafting as we head into those final days? Do you want the top of the round? Do you want the middle? Are you drafting at the turn and do it and controlling it from the 15 spot? I will be moderating this debate. And Shelley, we will start with you.
Yeah. So I actually do, like I mentioned before, I have my first main event ever this weekend. And how I set my KDS, well, of course, I chose the first overall pick because if you can't get Acuna, if you can get Acuna, that's who you want. But after that, I set it, you know, 9, 8, 7, and then flipped it back around. So if I don't get number one, I want in the middle. I want to be where I don't have like huge swings either way. Like at the turns, like you have two back-to-back picks, and then you have forever before you come back around. So while your turn is coming up, you have to like think of, you know, what position might be, like what run might be going, like if a reliever run might be going or a catcher run or something like that. And you just got to kind of be more proactive to take your guys instead of just kind of seeing where the draft kind of goes. So especially with my first main event, I want like a semi comfort level, and my comfort level is in the middle. I can just kind of watch everything as it goes, and there's no major, hopefully there's no major swings where I get, you know, I get too flustered and I just forget like, you know, what position I need, or, you know, just get just too wound up in the excitement of it all. So give me the middle, please.
Awesome. That's the case for the middle. Eric, you have 3 minutes to make your case.
Well, something Shelley said there was that you should go with your comfort level, and that's definitely true. So I think that any listeners who feel particularly comfortable in one part of the draft should ignore both of us and just go there, because you're going to end up with, you know, a full set of picks. It's going to be basically fine. So don't overthink it too much. But if pressed, I would certainly go for anything but the middle. I think by default, I set everything as just 1 through 15 or 1 through 12, depending on how many we're starting with, because the gap between the expected earnings of the first and second player is bigger than the gap between the second and third player, which is in turn bigger than third and fourth, et cetera. So the advantage you're getting from being one spot earlier in the first round is bigger than the advantage you're getting from being one spot earlier in the second. That's as a general rule. But then, of course, if you differ from the way ADP is going, you should invert your tiers, I think. So, for example, if you think that the player who's currently going second or the player you would pick second is currently going fourth, you definitely should go 4-3-2. And that's basically what I do. I usually go 1, maybe 5-4-3-2. And then sometimes I'll go from the middle on to the back after that. But I think I would really rather be at the end, not necessarily because of the players you can pick there, but I think I feel differently than Shelley during a draft. I really like being near the end because I can pair my picks. It's so frequently you're in a situation where you're like, well, I like two pitchers and four hitters here. Well, guess what? If you're near an end, you just pick one of the pitchers and you know you like any of those four hitters, you're going to get one of them coming back to you. So in some ways, being able to pair your picks like that, which you can only really do if you're near an end, I'd say probably within 2-3 spots of an end, that's something I really like. And you can't do that in the middle. In the middle, you're constantly being buffeted about by the draft or deciding to completely ignore it. And those are tough things to do. Whereas on the ends, I feel like you can actually do a little bit of both, get a bit of value and do a bit of, you know, trying to push the draft in the direction you're interested in. So I really like being able to pair things up like that.
It's a really great point that you made at the top there. And I just want to emphasize it, which is go with your comfort level, because a draft is a lot of pressure. And we've talked about this a bunch on the show before, whether you want a live draft or whether you're in a room full of a ton of people, like you're at First Pitch Arizona or you're in Vegas, you know, and you've got like people everywhere. You want to be comfortable with where you are. And so if the comfort level for you is the middle or the comfort level for you is the end, by all means, ignore our advice and do that. But I do like making the case for all of these things because I think all of them can be productive. Shelley, you mentioned the middle being sort of where you can take what the draft gives you in terms of, oh, there's a pitcher run, so I'm going to take this pitcher. Oh, there's a catcher run, so I'm going to take this catcher that I really like. From that perspective, do you plan your draft out as strategy like that, or as like, by which I mean, you're not going to panic if you don't have two starting pitchers by the ninth round, because perhaps that's just not where the draft has gone. And so you can take your next pitcher in the 10th round. You're a little bit more flexible.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I've said before on you know, other episodes, I try to kind of like mock wherever I happen to be drafting. I like to try to see who I might get. And then if there's a player that I like later, I will bump them up. So I just like the flexibility of the middle. And you could just see what the drafts give you. I'm definitely one of those ziggers while other people zag. Like you said, like if pitching, if I'm not feeling comfortable, I won't go over my quote unquote values and I will stick with hitting because eventually the people who are taking pitching have to take hitters and I'll just get pitchers. I won't freak out. That's why I like to just see what the draft room is doing and maybe that will help me later because I know that they need to go in a certain way and I need to go in another way. So, I mean, you know, it all works out, but I just like the middle because you can just kind of, it's like you're standing on like a mast of a boat. You can kind of see where all the waves are going and you can hopefully don't tip over.
You know, to take your boat analogy a little bit like farther, if you're on one of the ends of the boat, though, you can either steer, you can part like steer the draft in certain directions. Right. Eric, one of the things you said that I thought was super interesting, and this reminded me of our little table at Glarf. Actually, Eric and I were sitting at the same table with Mark Gannon from Baseball HQ. And the three of us, like every time somebody went who we had a good value, and we're like, that's a great value there. That's a great value there. And I'm like 99.9% certain we were all running values off the same auction calculator because it happened so frequently. But this idea of I want one, but then I want 5-4-3-2 because I'm going to get one of those guys in that same pocket, but it's going to be okay. Particularly from the end, if you're talking 14, 15, sometimes it's not this year necessarily, but some years I like picking from there because I think you actually double dip on values that are higher than you can get from the highest value player and the 30th value player. What do you think about all of that?
Yeah, I think that makes some sense. The only issue with, I think, the back of the draft this year, sometimes the back of round three and the start of round four just seems like it's a good deal worse than the start of round three. Often, you know, the start of round three still has some names that you're perfectly happy with the second round pick. And the back of round three, you can really start to feel, you know, if you got two bats, say with pick 13 and 18 or something, and most of the league has taken a starter by the time you even get your third pick, you can feel a little bit behind. I think that's the area of the draft where I most hate being late, is really in round three or four. By the time you get later in the draft, it's basically fine. And through rounds two, I actually do really like getting usually two big bats in where I've been drafting late. I have not ended up with either a Corbin Burns or a Zach Wheeler on that turn, but you can get two of your favorite of the big bats, the Aaron Judge, Yordan Alvarez, Matt Olson, Bryce Harper types. So I really like it there, but I'm not in love with it in the third and fourth round, which is why I would definitely still prefer to be in the early part than the late part.
We'll go into final rebuttals in just one second, but it is interesting how much of this is like, do you want to steer your draft or do you want to let the draft steer you? And that is a comfort level thing, as Eric said at the top. Eric is our guest. I'm going to give you a 1 minute rebuttal to start, and then we'll let Shelley close out this first debate.
Yeah, I think that really you should draft everywhere and get feeling comfortable with all of them. And really, for me, the reason I don't go in the middle is just I don't like that one isolated pick. I don't like the fact that there's always a medium size gap between picks. Maybe that actually is different if you're in, say, a slow draft where your gap's going to be pretty long. But if you're in a live draft and you're in the middle, you're picking every few minutes the whole time. And it's just demanding, I think, psychologically in a way that being on the ends are. So definitely go with your comfort zone. But that's why it's not my comfort zone in particular.
Shelley, your rebuttal.
Yeah, this is kind of like I was just thinking about this, like what you just said. You know, being on the ends, you can dictate, and being in the middle, you kind of watch and see where things are going. That's what I like to do in, like, you know, redraft leagues, right? So snakes. But in, you know, like salary caps, I really like to like bid up players all the time, keep it active, try to see where people are going. So I take different sides, if that makes sense. But, you know, in redraft, please give me the middle. It gives me more time to kind of see what people are doing. It gives me more time to think about, oh, they might be going here next, so let me take this guy. So it just gives me just that little bit more time, especially in like these fast drafts where you're going like a minute per pick, 50 seconds per pick. It just gives me just that little bit more time to kind of see where everything's going.
Love it. Shelley is going to moderate our second debate, but before she does, I'm going to just frame this a little bit because we're going to do two similar questions back to back here, but I think we can differentiate them in a way that is going to help our listeners out quite a bit. So the first question is about pitching from just a conceptual standpoint, like what is your strategy for approaching how you're trying to get pitching and where you're trying to get pitching in the draft? And then we're going to try to apply that to some recent second round ADPs because it is main event weekend. I have just run the main events that have happened so far, which means pitching is pushed way, 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 way up. This is probably not the same place that some of these pitchers are going in your home league, or if you're drafting on a site like CBS or Yahoo or something like that. So don't take these as gospel. But for purposes of a two-part question, really, we're going to do a two-part debate, strategy with pitching, followed by what that means early in a draft. And Shelley, bring us in.
Yeah. So like Sarah said, pitching is on the rise, basically because everyone seems to be hurt and everyone is freaking out about not getting their ace or their number two. So I just want to, you know, put it to you guys. Do you, at least in this current environment, do you like to go for ace early, or do you mind zigging while others are zagging? Eric, I will start with you.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because nearly always I prefer to be on the zigging side. I think that's how that works. In, you know, just reading the draft, seeing what's being valued in that particular room and trying to find values elsewhere is what generally makes me happiest as a drafter. I feel very clever when I get to do that. But I've been looking at who actually wins the main event and who actually finishes in the top three spots, trying to see if there was anything for an article there, but I didn't get far enough in it to turn it into some conclusive long piece of research. So I'll just give it here. At least in the last 5 years, your median first starting pitcher, if you want to finish top three in the main event, you take them in round two and your second starter in round five. Of the people who finished in the medals in the last 5 years, only one of them out of that would be 15 possible waited until round four to get their first starting pitcher. So that's really telling us, the results are really telling us that if you are just completely missing this ace tier, I mean, you might do well. I didn't look at all the teams. Maybe there's a bunch of people who finished fourth, fifth, seventh, ninth, or whatever, who waited a little bit. But the very best teams, they're taking a pitcher by round three, very often by round two. And yes, a ton of starting pitchers are getting injured early. That's going to keep happening. And, you know, with the pitch clock getting even smaller, maybe it'll happen even more. But if you want to actually win, you kind of need an ace and you just need to be the person who has their ace stay healthy. It's a tough situation to be in. And I think if you're not in maybe a league that has an overall component, I'd be much more open to saying, well, everybody else is going to try to compete for the best pitching staff. Looks like I've got the best hitting. Great. That's normally where I'd like to be in some places, but I don't think we can ignore the evidence that says that if you want to do really well in some of the most competitive fantasy leagues, you need to draft at least one starting pitcher early. A few of them even had their second starting pitcher in round two. I think three of the 15 in this sample went pocket aces. You don't have to do that, but you really do kind of need one.
See, and honestly, I kind of want to make the case for pocket aces, although I think I made that case last week because one of the things I was thinking about when we were talking about being at those ends, right? Like being at 15 or being at 1-2 this year, I actually think you have a tremendous opportunity in this particular draft class to grab two of your starting pitchers off the top before anybody else has to, and then figure out the hitter closer situation, right? And I think you can do this one of two ways. You can do this really early by bumping Strider way up. You could bump him up to 1-1 if you wanted to, although I still think Acuna should go 1-1, but like people are taking Strider 1-1, and I think that is 100% defensible given where we're at in draft season right now. But if you take Strider and whatever ace falls back to you, which I almost did in Tout Wars, I was real close to taking Strider and Kirby there. Or if you're at the end and you take like Wheeler and Burns, you have now set up a situation where everybody else is going to push pitching up too, but you have distinguished yourself in that pitching category and you can roll bats slightly differently. Now, you're missing out on a big bat. Like you're definitely missing out on your, like no Harper bat is going to fall to you. Your Aaron Alvarez does not exist in the third round. There are some guys who maybe you could make a case have that type of upside. It requires that you do some really risky things. You have to very much believe in an Ellie De La Cruz, or very much believe in a Wyatt Langford having just an absolute breakout at some point, right? Like, there are ways to make it work. But I do think that if pitching is being pushed up, you only have two ways to react to it. Well, you have three. And I like the first two better than the other one. You can do what everybody else is doing, get your ace in rounds like 1, 2, 3, and just get your ace. You can ignore it and go full hitter build. I like that more in a 12-teamer than a 15-teamer. I don't think you can pull that off in a 15-teamer very easily. Or you can force your own advantage at pitcher and take two aces. And I sort of like the idea of creating a little bit of chaos and forcing my own advantage. So I partially agree that you have to go early, and I would double up on that and say you have to go early and make it a strength for you.
Yeah, I mean, y'all both bring great things. And like I said, I'm like picking in like the middle. So I don't know if I'll be able to do that, but it sounds like really, I mean, obviously, you know, Eric brought in the evidence, like you need those starters. And that's why we always see, like, every spring, every main event season, we see those starters go higher and higher and higher. So do y'all have any rebuttals? I mean, y'all, you know, really good cases.
I might have just agreed with Eric and made this debate.
I'll rebut your pocket aces thing just a little bit. And that's that I really like being in a position where any value that falls to me, I can take it, right? Especially, you know, rounds 3 through 10 or so. If there's a player that I don't love, but I think he's, you know, fairly valued and the whole room hates him, I want to be able to get him regardless of whether he's a hitter or a pitcher, regardless of whether he's a speed guy, a power guy. So if I leave the first few rounds with balance, then I can do whatever I want. If I leave the first two rounds with pocket aces and the value that falls to me in round 5 or 6 is a pitcher, I don't think it's responsible to get a third pitcher, maybe by round 6. I think in the three teams that did go pocket aces, one of them, their third starter was round 6. The others were round 8 and 9. But the main thing that pocket aces does is it just says, hey, you are picking hitters for the next several picks. You better like it. And, you know, there's a few rounds where there aren't even that many hitters. Rounds 5 and 6 in the main event had about 4 and 5 hitters going in them. So you better like guys in those range if you're going to consider pocket aces. And even if you do, you are committing in round 2 to your next several picks being a certain way. And that totally can work, but you definitely are cutting off some serious flexibility there.
So the only thing that I would rebut there, because you're absolutely right, you're like committing yourself to a strategy. And this is, again, part of why I like doing this at the ends and I don't like doing it in the middle as much, because in the middle, you want that flexibility that Shelley was talking about earlier. You want to be able to like take what comes to you and take the best values and whatnot. At the ends, you're sort of crafting your own strategy and you're like, okay, I want to have a catcher by round 8, or I got to start the catcher run, because if the catcher run starts on the wrong side of the board, the whole tier is gone before it comes back. The one thing I like about this pocket aces strategy, and I'm going to quote our friend Derek Van Riper on this one, because I heard him talking about this the other day. I don't think it was on Rates and Barrels, but he's been doing a bunch of guest spots lately, so I could be wrong about where this was. He mentioned that you wind up shopping for different things than everybody else when you do the pocket aces strategy. And so you find like everybody else is looking for their second starter in round 5, round 4. You're looking at hitters, and those hitters are, there's some pretty good bats available there where I'm normally taking a pitcher, right? Like a Cody Bellinger might fall to you. Well, Cody Bellinger hit 300 with 20 and basically did like a 2020 campaign, but could be 25-25 pretty easily if he had played a full season, hitting low in that Cubs lineup, lots of RBIs, lots of runs. That's not quite like your Bryce Harper bat, but it's pretty darn close, right? Like, it's going to give you a lot of value if he can pull something like that off. A Matt McClain can fall to you there. Matt McClain is a guy who I think got really pushed down this draft season because he started with that oblique injury. He's going to be ready for opening day. He has a job. He plays every day. He's dual eligible at second base and shortstop. Again, 2020 guy, really decent average hitter, hits in the heart of a Reds lineup that is pretty good. Those are some hitters that I find myself missing out on in a lot of drafts because I need to take a pitcher there or I need to take a closer there. And if I've created a strategy where I can shop for those hitters, I do think there are some values that I would like to take advantage of. But Eric, I agree with you. You've got to be really deliberate about who those are, right? And you really want to hope that if you're doing a strategy like that, you're the only person in the room doing that strategy. Because I think a lot of the value in something like the pocket aces or double tapping closers or those types of strategies comes from being unique and not chasing the same thing somebody else also needs.
Yeah. Y'all did really well. I do have just like one like small little question. Sarah, when you do take the pocket aces, how do you feel about taking a closer? Because that's what kind of scares me off about the strategy, because I've been trying to get like the top tier closers this draft season, and it's kind of hit, you know, bit me in the butt because everyone keeps getting hurt. But, you know, with the, so if you take, you know, you do the pocket aces, where do you feel comfortable in taking a closer?
This is a great question. And actually, I'm not sure I should be giving advice on this, because the two closers that I have taken most frequently first overall are Devin Williams and Johan Duran. So we all know how that is working out for me. Although I've done an okay job of at least backing up the Williams part of that in the drafts I was in, because I figured he might get traded and I could take like a super late flyer on a Joel Piance or something. And so I do have some cover there. But again, dependent on being at the end, and I'm usually thinking of this from like the 13, 14, 15 spot, not the 1, 2, 3 spot, although you could do it with a Strider Kirby build or some Strider Lopez build or something like that. If I was at the back end of the draft, I would probably go starting pitcher, the best bat off the board, whatever, the first closer off the board or the best closer off the board. And then I would roll hitters until about round 9, maybe round 10. And then I would take my third starting pitcher or the next closer I needed. And then I would just take what the draft handed to me after that point. If I was at the front end, I would probably go starting pitcher, batter, something like that. And then I'd have to wait on closer to come back to me and pray that that first tier of closer came all the way back. Right. That strikes me as a little bit more risky trying to get that to come back. So I don't love that one nearly as much, although then you do get the value of having Strider plus.
Right. Nice.
Yeah,
Eric, tough. Do you have it's any comments?
Yeah, I was going to say it's tough to fit in a closer in before like round 6. I mean, you said you might do it in round 4, which is that's hard. You're just leaving round 4 with only one hitter when everybody else has 2 and 3 and sometimes 4. It's just you're committing to being behind and you can't be good everywhere. I think if I did start with 2 starters, I think I'm sacrificing saves and probably not looking at my first closer until something like round 7 or 8. There are maybe some decent ones if somebody falls to like the back around 6, maybe a Clay Holmes, Ryan Helsley type, something like that. Maybe if I've gone 2 aces and then 3 hitters, because then, you know, you leave round 5, you've got 3 bats. That's, you're not feeling well behind. But if you leave round 5 with only 2 bats and neither of them were in the first 2 rounds, that's tough for me to get behind, I think.
I think it's about who you're targeting there and who actually falls to you. So I admittedly, like, there's some, this depends on some guys getting to you that really can make a difference. But here are some names that I like that I think make this strategy potentially work. JT Realmuto gives you a catcher who's going to get you 15 to 20 steals and hit 275. While putting up decent counting stats because he plays in a really good lineup. That gives you an advantage at catcher that is distinct from the advantage other people are going to have at catcher. So he's not a first round bat, but he's giving you a lineup advantage that is different than what other people are going to get. I already mentioned Matt McClain and Cody Bellinger, who I think both do a nice job here, but Cody Bellinger's uniquely, I think if you're taking him there, you're also taking part of the like outfield first base flexibility that he gives right. you, because now like, getting 20 stolen bases out of your first baseman is cash money. Nobody else who is going to do that for you in this game, right? And you can now sort of like, do I want a first baseman later? Do I want an outfielder later? I think you're also banking on, and this is something I have not done pocket aces a lot this year, but I have done this a lot this year, and I feel pretty confident about it. That middle tier of outfielders that has question marks in it, you're banking on taking a lot of those guys and hoping for the upside for them. So I think you're taking like more Evan Carters and Wyatt Linkfords, not both of them, but like one or the other, and hoping that they really exceed expectations rather than say a Brian Reynolds, who is just like a super high floor guy. And so I think you have to take some different chances to make something like this work. But I do think what you get from it, and see, you mentioned it as that you're costing yourself later. I think of it as an opportunity. You're getting that opportunity of, I do not have to worry about starting pitching the same way all the rest of these people do. And I can just skip a tier. If there's a tier of starting pitchers that I am just super not into and I don't like, I can wait for that tier to pass and I can get my number three starting pitcher in like the Yu Darvish tier that I like a little bit more.
Yeah, fair enough. Do we have some specific early pitchers who are getting pushed up? You want to?
Yeah, we should. For a bit? We actually need to take a quick break for our sponsors first. So on the flip side, we're going to apply this to some specific starting pitchers. And Shelly and Eric are going to tell us which pitchers they are most into. But first, a quick break.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
All right. So speaking of specific round cases, let's make the cases for your aces. Round two of the NFBC main event ADP. I want each of you to pick just one. We're going to presume not pocket aces for the purposes of this debate, but pick one of Corbin Burnes, Zach Wheeler, Luis Castillo, George Kirby, or Pablo Lopez. Who is your ace? And Eric, we'll start with you.
I think I could go Zach Wheeler out of that group, and we may end up agreeing here. I am not like super confident about it, but this might be my Phillies fandom showing. Maybe it's harder to trust the aces on your own team because, hey, if they get hurt in April, then your real life season and your fantasy season is completely tanked. And I think everybody is a little bit more nervous about their own team stars breaking. Zach Wheeler hasn't given us many specific reasons to fear that he's going to break down. He's had, you know, his fair share of minor things, and he's 34 this season. That's really the main reason I would be hesitant about him, but it's not like Corbin Burnes is super young and his numbers have taken a step back. I think Wheeler and Burnes going right near each other in drafts. Wheeler is pretty much holding on to his strikeout rate and walk rate. Basically just the same guy he's been for several years, whereas Corbin Burnes has lost about 5 points on his strikeout rate in two consecutive seasons. That was a similar reason I was worried about Gerrit Cole, was that he lost about 5 points last year with a velocity drop, and I wasn't sure I wanted to push him up into the late first round. Similarly, with Corbin Burnes trending in the wrong direction, do I really want to take him that early? Again, even with Wheeler, with his age, I'm a little bit nervous about it, and that's why when I'm in, you know, the back of the first round where you would probably be getting Wheeler early in the second, I have so far gone with another pitcher. But if we're in a world where we have to push the top pitchers up, Wheeler is the guy who gets closest to sneaking into the back of the first round for me.
Shelly, you're up.
Yeah, I think we're going to agree. You know, when I was, you know, researching this, I thought I was going to go with Burnes just because, you know, the move of the ballpark, the Orioles should be pretty good. I mean, they were good last year. And, you know, he's on a contract year because it seems very unlikely that he's going to come to terms with Baltimore, who just traded for him. So this is like, you know, his make or break year. He's got to get that big time contract. So, but I'm still going with Wheeler here. I looked back from like 2001 through last year, and Wheeler has a slightly smaller K percentage over that time. So we have, so it was like a 25% for Burns and I think a 23% for Wheeler. And then on the other side of the coin, Wheeler has a slightly higher, walk rate to Kirby, to George Kirby. So it's kind of like Burns and Kirby together make Wheeler, while they're not going to have like the same like high end, right? You're going to get like this nice juicy middle. So give me Wheeler. He just seems like you can just set it and forget it. And he seems totally safe, which is probably, I probably just doomed him. So I am sorry, Eric.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say, as I was thinking about this, one of the things that gave me confidence about both Zach Wheeler and Corbin Burns, and I'm curious how y'all think about this, is, you know, when you have just moved or when you have just signed an extension, there's usually some pretty extensive medicals that go along with that. And so it's not like, you know, it's pretty clear from the news we get out of spring training at the start of spring training every year. These guys just don't go to doctors in the off season. They're like, oh, it'll get better. I'll be fine. And I don't understand how that's possible. I think if I were running a team, one of the first things I would do is be like, hey, we're going to have like an annual medical exam on the way out. Like, so you get treatment for whatever has been ailing you for the entire time. I'm sure there's some reason the Players Association would not want to commit to that, but come on, y'all, like, heal in the off season and know what is broken in the off season. That I feel like if you just signed an extension or you moved, somebody did that medical research or at least kind of checked in on it. Clearly it's not perfect because Lucas Giolito is over there in Tommy John and he just moved. So it's obviously not a perfect science, but I am curious with Zach Wheeler in particular, because I love Zach Wheeler too. He's probably my favorite of this group. If I were debating this out, I might have picked Luis Castillo just because I really like that park and I like what Luis Castillo's done the last couple of years. But I do like Zach Wheeler. Hand to God, I like Zach Wheeler the most out of all of these pitchers too. So it's a trifecta. Y'all, I'm curious for each of you. Wheeler jumps out despite the ballpark. And what do you think that means for him in the context of some of these other guys? Eric, I'll start with you.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because the ballpark definitely hurts him. And if I had him, you know, more tied with the other guys on skills, I would have Wheeler at the back. So maybe it's just a little bit of consistency keeps him there. And with guys that are this early, you're using them every start. So it's not as if we can say, well, you know, here's a tough park, but we'll just skip his two toughest starts at home. You're not doing that with your ace. So that does maybe give a little bit more downside. And we see with Aaron Nola, when he has his off years, his ERA really jumps, even though his underlying skills aren't that bad. It's not impossible to see a year where Zach Wheeler is basically the same guy, but has his ERA jump by a run. So maybe I'm arguing against all of us by saying that. I think it's definitely is something that should be included. And I think the fact that so many of us, you know, the three of us included, are just saying, yeah, Wheeler's our number two, despite that park, despite that age, I really would not be considering Wheeler to be the normal level of second starting pitcher, I think. And that's why I wouldn't be pushing him too far up. I think it really is just we're in a world where too many of the top tier pitchers are injured right now or have injury questions. And so we're really looking at a bunch of 1Bs who are this year's 1As after Spencer Strider. Maybe I'm too negative there. And again, maybe that's just Philly's pessimism, but I think there's some real negatives, even if I'm not pushing anybody else ahead of Wheeler into number two.
Yeah, Shelley, same question for you. How do you evaluate the park factor here? Because I mean, I look at particularly like Castillo and Kirby, they get to pitch in a park that is just like pitcher's heaven, as far as I can tell. Like, just go to Seattle, be good pitcher. That's how this works now. But in all honesty, Philadelphia is not that place. So how do you consider the park factors?
Yeah, I guess when it comes to aces, I don't necessarily look at that because I believe in their skills enough to, like Eric said, I'm going to start him at every single start. I'm going to grin and bear it when he has to go to Colorado. And I'm just going to like close my eyes, but I'm going to start him at every start. So I don't necessarily take ballpark factors really into account unless, you know, it's like unless it's like a tiebreaker situation. So, you know, like Eric said, like, if I thought his skills were more in line with like a Pablo Lopez or George Kirby, then yeah, that would come into effect. But I just think that Wheeler is, I mean, honestly, we just have like one starting pitcher and then we have like a 1A. And honestly, I think 1A now is Zach Wheeler. And then we go to like two, because I do think Corbin Burns, I'm like Eric said, I am concerned about his like declining strikeout rate. But I just, for me personally, I just think Wheeler has now, with all the injuries, is now my 1A. And I'm just not going to think about his ballpark.
Hey, just put it out of your mind. That's fine. Nothing to see here. Nothing to see here at all. Do we need to do any rebuttals here since we basically all agree on Wheeler? And this is really just like us coming to terms with the fact that starting pitcher has been demolished.
Yeah, I think that sums it up.
Awesome. We're going to head into another series of debates that are kind of related to each other and should be a little bit of fun. As aces get pushed up, some of the middle infielders are getting pushed down. And in the fifth round, you have some choices to make. We're going to look at two of them with our next two debates. For the first one, one that I find myself really looking at a lot is Nico Horner or Matt McClain, who generally go within two or three picks of each other. They are both second base and shortstop eligible. They bring some different packages to the table in terms of what they can accomplish, but they both hit low in the lineup for pretty good offenses. So one of your choices might be which value second base shortstop do you want? And is it Nico or Matt McClain? I'm going to moderate this debate because we all know I would have said Nico Horner. Shelley, we'll start with you.
This was actually like pretty easy for me. But coming into draft season, so let's just say November, I probably would have had this flipped. But for me right now, it is definitely Nico. Matt McClain, just his reoccurring like oblique injury in the early part of spring. And now, you know, today as we're talking Tuesday afternoon, he was scratched with like some shoulder soreness. And it's just for some reason, this spring training, it always seems something that is nagging him. And I mean, the Reds have been demolished by injuries and, you know, some PED suspensions. So I don't necessarily think that there was like really any playing time, concerns with him prior to all of this stuff. But now he's going to play if he's healthy. I just don't feel comfortable taking him where he's currently going, because at that point, I still want players that I feel confident that are going to get plenty of plate appearances. And I really don't feel as scared about Nico. He's going to be hitting leadoff. He's going to get plenty of stolen bases. Yeah, he's not going to hit as many home runs as Matt McClain if they all stay healthy, right? I just give me the quote-unquote safety of Nico.
From your mouth to Wrigley Field. Eric, make the case for Matt McClain.
Yes, interesting that Shelley said that this has flipped for her during spring training, because it has for me as well, in the opposite direction. Yes, there's some minor worries with Matt McClain, but I think that the fact that we're not going to have Noelvi Marte on the Reds for the first half of the season due to his PED suspension, that to me is a bigger positive effect for McClain's playing time than his minor nagging injuries are as a negative, although they are something we should pay attention to. I don't think we should completely ignore them. But the main reason I would go McClain over Horner is that for all of my draft picks, I want to be able to envision a world where they finish up two or three rounds better than I pick them. I want to pick them at a place where, you know, if they just live up to expectations, I'm happy, but they have a real chance of exceeding them. And I'm not sure Nico Horner has anything else left to offer. I think he is a safe option. I think he is going to steal a ton of bases. He had 43 last year. He's probably going to finish top 10, top 15 this year. He's probably going to have a very good batting average. I mean, he always has a low strikeout rate, and he's fast. So that locks you in, basically, to a good batting average. But he also is going to do absolutely nothing else. I mean, he has no power. He has a barrel rate for his career of 1.8%. That is 1.8% higher than you and me. He barely hits the ball hard at all. He got 10 homers once, and I would never project him really to be above that. And so if I'm picking Nico Horner, I just know I'm picking speed and batting average in some runs and zero in the power stats. Matt McClain, on the other hand, could certainly have a worse season. And I bet the 50th percentile outcome for both of these guys, it's better for Nico Horner. But Matt McClain actually has upside, right? He has some minor strikeout issues, but he has real power to go along with his speed. There is a world where he puts it all together, and we're talking about him as a second-round pick next year. I don't think there's any world in which Nico Horner moves up more than like maybe a round if he just does it again and other guys get hurt. I think Nico Horner just is who he is, and if who he is just a speed and contact guy. And hey, we know that BABIP can vary from year to year too. So there's even a chance that one of the few areas where he does contribute, he ends up being way worse through no fault of his own if all of his ground balls just find an opposing infielder. So I just don't see a world where Nico really outperforms his draft price. If I had gotten that far with, say, no middle infielder and no real speed, totally a fine pick. I think he's completely adequate where he's going. I just would really want to be able to envision myself, being quite happy at the end of the year with a pick. And I just don't know if there's a world where that's true for Nico.
It's interesting what you say about getting to that point in the draft where you're like, oh, I need speed. Like I find myself drafting a lot of Nico when I've taken like Juan Soto and Yordan Alvarez at the top, or like that is the build where I find myself like, Nico Horner's right there and I'm going to take him and his, I think it's going to be 50 steals this year. I think he's going to run more than he did last year. He had a little bit of a nagging hamstring issue in the middle months of the summer that slowed him down a bit. You can sort of see that in the number of stolen base attempts he had. But Eric, I guess my question for you is, the upside I see with Nico, because I agree with you, he is 100% a batting average speed guy. I think he has a shot to hit better than 285. I think that he's done that so far, but he could hit 300. Like if he hit 310 this year, I would not be stunned. It's a very good contact tool. And it's only gotten better with all of his exposure in the big leagues. And I think he could be a 50 plus steals guy, maybe even a 60. 60 seems like I'm pushing it a little bit, but I think 40 might be where he started with the new rules and he's going to push that envelope a little bit. Do you think that moves the needle for you if he becomes like a 300 batting average, 50, 55 steal guy?
Maybe a little bit, but I think it's that I don't want to be relying too much on that batting average because, again, it's just is at the whims of BABIP where power isn't in the same way. And so I guess for him to get a better batting average, I'm looking at Nico's expected batting averages the last few years. He actually hit 281 and 283. His expected batting average was 270 and 273. Now, I would think with his speed, he can overperform that by about 10 points. But nothing in his numbers so far say that, he's underachieved and we should expect him to get to 300. I think that is the route at which he performs slightly better. But unless, is he really going to shave 3-4 points off a strikeout rate that's already down at 11 or 12%? Maybe, but I think his route to hitting over 300 is just some BABIP luck, and I don't want to be betting on that.
Totally fair. Shelley, you made the excellent point about injuries and Matt McClain, who Matt McClain is one of my favorite players. I picked him up in Fab last year. He definitely saved me in two leagues, and honestly, I think the reason that I faded down the stretch in Tout Wars and wound up finishing fifth was because Matt McClain hit the IL and I couldn't replace that production. It was like 2020 pace production and I just couldn't. There was nothing on the waiver wire that was even close. I hate the idea that he might be a guy who deals with injuries so much that we're always like, what if Matt McClain put it together just one time? But I wanted to ask you, the depth that the Reds have, yes, Noel V. Marte is suspended. Yes, McClain has a job. They have options at second base. There's no reason to put him in the lineup if he's feeling even a tiny bit sore. And I think this is a team that would like to be relevant deep in August and September and maybe even sniff the postseason. So I wonder, do you think that playing time risk increases because they do have options to play behind him?
Yeah, I really do. Even with, Marte's suspension and them losing Friedel, which kind of opens up a little bit of outfield time for Jonathan India, who has played like a little bit of outfield and first base during spring. They want to keep him healthy. He's a fantastic player. He's extremely fun to watch. I loved watching the Reds last year, down the stretch. They were just so much fun. Him and Ellie, just the entire team. Joey Votto just doing Joey Votto things. It was great. But if they want to be in the postseason, which I really do think that they do, based on at least the hitting moves, this offseason, and they made a few pitching moves, I think they want to be relevant. And you might, there might be like that odd Sunday, that odd Saturday, Sunday that he just sits because his oblique's a little sore, or you know, his shoulder is just not quite right. And they're like, oh, just take a day, take a day. And those little off days could add up. And I just don't have that fear with Nico. Obviously, anything can happen because baseball will baseball. But I just like the, at least I know Nico is healthy now. I'm not 100% confident that McLain is. So that's why I'm kind of leading Nico here.
Awesome. Eric, you're up for a 1 minute rebuttal.
Yeah, I guess maybe I am not thinking enough about McLain's current injury issue. And I'll say that if we get one more negative piece of news from him in the last few days, then I'll probably flip it. But the most recent news for McLain was, at least the most recent news at RotoWire, is titled "Expected to be fine." So I'm reading that as good news. Reds manager David Bell said Tuesday that McLain is expected to be fine. Sounds pretty good. So if this latest one was just a, you know, ordinary spring thing, and then really the only notable event we're thinking about this spring was that he had that oblique tweak back right when he showed up at camp. If it's really only the one significant thing, you don't like it, but I'm not yet viewing him as someone who's really had a horrible spring where they're just out of the lineup all the time. It's definitely worth watching, though. So there's certainly some downside, maybe more than I'm giving credit for here.
Shelley, your rebuttal.
Yeah, I guess where they're going, just give me somewhat safety. Give me as many plate appearances as I can. I just feel better with Nico.
Totally reasonable. And for the record, I wish I knew if the oblique tweak that Eric was referring to was the same oblique that, like, it was his oblique bothering him for 6 months, because that worries me a lot more than if his oblique, like, it's a totally different oblique.
It was the same. It's the right oblique both times. Whatever.
Yeah, it's the same area, right? Like, I just, yeah. I don't know. Like, obviously, we're never going to get the full medicals here. Awesome. Same idea, different guys. Shelley's going to moderate our next debate.
Yeah, so one of the most exciting players in spring training has been O'Neill Cruz. He has been demolishing baseballs, which has been, you know, so much fun to see. And you know, he has slowly been creeping up that ADP, you know, by, you know, he's around pick 75 through the end of February, like through main events. So that's pretty amazing. Just, and I think it's just, you know, him, you know, hitting all these home runs where everyone can see, but I would love to pick both of y'all brains. Do y'all go with the hype train? Do you go with, you know, the, you know, go on cruise control? Or are you going to do any of the alternatives? I mean, we got, you know, Adelis Garcia, we got Randy Rosarena, we got Manny Machado all going around there. So I really want to know, are you going to go with Cruz, or are you going to go with, you know, a more quote unquote reliable guy? Sarah, I'll start with you.
So before there was Ellie De La Cruz and 99th percentile sprint speed and 99th percentile hard hit, and look at the barrel rates, and oh my God, he's like so tall and he plays shortstop, there was O'Neill Cruz. And O'Neill Cruz is exactly the same skill set of Ellie De La Cruz, except he hit some bumps on the way to the show. We had injuries. We had the ankle. We even had like the same strikeout issues, right? Like as adapting to the league and all of those things. And so what I see in O'Neill Cruz is the culmination of finally, he has worked out the kinks. He is no longer a rookie. He is going to get playing time and he is healthy. And we can see what the movie was supposed to be from the start. And I am excited about this particular movie. Now, it's a little bit build dependent, right? I don't think I'm taking O'Neill Cruz if I've done a pretty typical build here and I need a third baseman and I'm worried about Manny Machado falling. And then I have to think about Nolan Arenado or Alex Bregman instead. And I'd much rather have Manny Machado. Like, I'm probably going to take, in that safe build, a Manny Machado. But if I'm doing something like what I said earlier, pocket aces, I took a hitter and then a closer, and now I need to load up on bats, and I need bats who can overperform what I think that they're going to do, O'Neill Cruz is right there, and I love him for this. I think that he is a guy who is going in the fifth round-ish, who could give you second-round value. And that's the type of player that, to Eric's point earlier, if I'm looking for guys who can exceed that round where they're going's value, O'Neill Cruz is that guy for me. And I think he is that guy more so than any of these other guys, even though both Adelise Garcia and Randy Arozarena were this guy in previous drafts. Like, I want to be very clear. They are also that same skill set of, like, you thought we were like 15, 20 guys and we're actually like 25, 30 guys and we're just going to rake. And I think O'Neill Cruz is just the next iteration of that. He's a little bit younger. We haven't seen it before. Get him here while you can.
Yeah, that was great. Eric.
Yeah, I can't do it with O'Neill Cruz. And I think that we just needed a year. We need one more year of seeing him put things together before I'm even considering him in the first four rounds now. He was at pick 75 through the end of February. He was at 54 in the main event. And man, that's the price I want to pay after we've seen a full season of O'Neill Cruz doing his thing at the major league level, however good that ends up looking like. After we've seen that for a year, that's when he's going to, I think, look a whole lot like the Adelise Garcias and Randy Arozarenas of the world. But his ankle injury means we lost the year of seeing him prove it last year. We got 9 games. And I think that all his exciting spring highlights this last few weeks are making us forget just how much he had to prove. There was a lot to love in his 87 games in 2022, 17 homers, 10 steals, but a 35% strikeout rate. That's huge. That's not just high. You know, if this was, you know, upper 20s like Matt McClain, you say, all right, he's got a contact problem. He's probably going to run a low batting average. 35%, that's pushing, you know, Joey Gallo territory. That's pushing, we're not sure this will work. It's probably going to. I'm not in any way saying this is going to completely blow up for O'Neill Cruz, but you do not see everyday regulars with a 35% strikeout rate often. I wanted to see 1 year of him cutting down that mark, even to 30, 31, 32, then I'd be much more interested in him this year. I think he's going to have some struggles this year. I think this is the year where he's really going to start putting it all together, but he lost that year of development. And the other reason I'm not that excited of jumping him that far is I think the comparisons with Ellie De La Cruz are wrong in one key area, and that's speed. Ellie De La Cruz called himself the fastest man in the world, like week one of his MLB career, and he has 100th percentile sprint speed. So for those purposes, he was correct. O'Neill Cruz, I think he actually was pretty up there in 2022, but he only stole 10 bases in 87 games. Yes, that was pre the new rules, but that's, you know, if you're close to the fastest man in baseball, you don't steal only 10 bases in 87 games. So if he doesn't have, you know, the chance of that, you know, 50 steal season like Ellie De La Cruz has, if it's more like, you know, if he puts it all together, he's going 25-25. All right, that's very exciting. But if the 60-70 steals aren't even on the table, he's just a categorically different guy than Ellie De La Cruz. He no longer looks like someone who could lead the league in one category and be really exciting everywhere. He's just someone who's flawed but interesting across the board. And a player like that, I guess I just need to see more than half a season 2 years ago to really consider him with my fourth or fifth round pick.
Yeah, that's a fairly interesting, you know, comparison between the Cruises, because, you know, O'Neill like fractured his ankle and he's only stolen one base. He has also hit 7 home runs, so he probably could have stolen maybe 2 bases, you know. but yeah, it's a very interesting combination of you know profiles, because we do think that they're very similar, but it's like, I kind of think that Cruz maybe has like a little bit more power. So I think that you're kind of like weighing things there. But Sarah, do you have any rebuttals?
Yeah, I have two. And I hear you on the year of development and wanting to see it before you're in on the guy. But I also know that Ellie De La Cruz goes like 20, 30 picks before O'Neill Cruz right now. And so it's kind of one of these situations where I'm like perfectly happy to get the exact same player 30 picks later. There is a guy who struck out close to 35% of the time in his first year through the league. It's Ellie De La Cruz. He struck out 33.7% of the time during that time because they are basically the same player. There are other guys like this. Christopher Morel is a good example, who's another guy I'm super high on. What do all three of these players have in common? They come into the league. They're like 22 years old. They're really young for playing in the major leagues, and they're trying to figure some stuff out, but the tools are so loud that they just stick around, because they can hit 25 to 30 home runs in Major League Baseball, even though they haven't figured it all out yet. And the reason I bring that up is not, to be clear, I do not think Christopher Morales, Ellie De La Cruz, or O'Neal Cruz, but I'm just saying there are guys who can make this profile work. And the guys who can make it work are generally very toolsy. O'Neal Cruz had a 98th percentile sprint speed in 2022 when he was up the first time through. Now, admittedly, we don't know what that looks like after the ankle injury. And as Shelley mentioned, he hasn't really had a lot of chances to run. He just keeps hitting home runs and that gets in the way of running. But the thing that I think about with stolen bases, I'm less hung up on this 10 number than Eric is. And it's mainly because I think the rules changed everything. Running is as much a team philosophy as it is anything else. And if I'm any team in Major League Baseball right now, what I saw from the Reds, the Cubs, the Diamondbacks, the teams who really overperformed last year, is that they ran a lot. They ran all the time. And we have to run more if we want to be competitive. And if I have a guy with 98th percentile sprint speed, he is going to run.
Yeah, I guess the question is just going to be how much that sprint speed remains after ankle surgery. And given that he's only stolen once, if he steals like three more bases or something over the next week, then maybe I should be thinking of him differently. And maybe that would also be an overreaction to, you know, three spring steals. But I think it matters because the reason why I'm comfortable taking Ellie if he drops a little bit is because I think he's going to finish top five in steals. Like, I'm quite confident about that for Ellie. Even if the bat takes no steps forward, all he has to do is be in the lineup. And I think the fact that the Reds kept him in the lineup down the stretch last year, even when he was really quite terrible at the plate, between that and the lack of Noelvi Marte early, I think that Ellie's just going to be in the lineup all the time. So he's going to get me a ton of steals, even if things don't go well elsewhere. That, to me, actually gives him a floor, which he doesn't seem like a high floor player at all. I'm not saying it's a high floor, but it's a much more respectable floor than I think Ellie gets credit for. Whereas O'Neal, given that we haven't seen him try to steal, you know, 50 bases yet, I don't think we can say his floor is, well, at least he steals a ton. I think his floor is none of it works and he really struggles.
I think his floor is 40 home runs, but that was unfair because that's, I'm not supposed to get another rebuttal. We actually need to take a quick break for our sponsors. On the flip side, we will have some Love It or Leave It and a little bit more with our guest, Eric Halterman. All right, we are back. We have one more debate. We have our Love It or Leave It. Our guest here is Eric Halterman from RotoWire, and we're having a blast on this episode. Eric, you are going to moderate us on this debate, and this is one that is near and dear to my heart because it's impacting me in like half a dozen leagues.
Yeah, this was one that I was thinking about a lot over the weekend at Tout Wars NL Only because I was trying to find some viable second closers in a deep league, or maybe if you're in a big mixed league, you'll want to find a viable third closer to take a shot at. And that is with Devin Williams' injury opening up a new closer job. There's some names that we are potentially interested in Milwaukee, whether that is Joel Piamps, Abner Uribe, maybe Trevor Megill. So, but my question is, given that this is probably only a half season closer job, and given that there's like not a lot to separate those three Brewers relievers, are you chasing the saves in Milwaukee, the half season worth of saves, or would you rather just go with the next man up in some other bullpen? Maybe that's, you know, an Andrew Nardi backing up Tanner Scott, who seems shaky, that sort of thing. Would you rather try to get someone who could get half a season's worth of saves in Milwaukee? Let's start with you, Shelley. Are you going with a Milwaukee closer, or would you look elsewhere?
I would definitely go with the Milwaukee because, like, in your specific question with the Miami situation with Scott and Nardi, we still don't know. At least in Milwaukee, someone has to close. So I have a 1-in-3 shot versus maybe not even having a shot. So give me the small little snippet of hope that I can probably pick up a closer somewhat cheaply, somewhat late.
And with the rest of you making your case here, which of those closers would it be in Milwaukee? Who are you making a case for?
Yeah, for me, it's going to be Joel Piamps. And it's honestly, I like Uribe better. He's younger. He has more strikeout potential. But Milwaukee is kind of a sad to say, they're kind of a cheap team. And they probably want to keep Uribe's price, you know, for arbitration purposes down. And Joel Piamps is 30 years old. So that is why I'm just going with the older guy because I'm hoping, I'm banking on Milwaukee being trying to be cheap instead of trying to go with a good strikeout guy. So that's where I'm kind of hitting.
All right, Sarah, it's really a two-parter here. Are you going with a Milwaukee reliever over somebody else from some other bullpen? And if so, which one?
I'm going with the Milwaukee reliever for the same reason that Shelley said. I think that you at least have certainty that somebody is going to get a shot at these jobs. Whereas if you're looking at some of the other guys that go in this range, like Yennier Cano goes right between where Piamps and Uribe have gone in the main event so far. And it's like, what I know about Yennier Cano is that the Baltimore Orioles went out and got Craig Kimbrell so that Cano wouldn't have to close this year. I know they don't want Cano to close and they want Craig Kimbrell to close. So he is both an injury away from closing and like they might bring somebody else in to keep him from closing on that competitive team. Right. So I like the idea of having some certainty that somebody else is going to do it. And for the second part of that question, it's Uribe for me. And this is one of those times where I'm just going with my heart and I'm going with skills over everything else. Because when I watch Abner Uribe pitch, he blows my mind. It is 101 miles per hour with sink and a slider that is so filthy. I haven't seen a slider this filthy from like a 23, 24 year old in a hot minute. It is beautiful. It is pitching ninja gift city. And the biggest problem for Abner Uribe last season, who did get a save in his rookie campaign, and I don't think we should overlook this. He was on my radar when I was doing research for the first pitch Arizona rookie league draft, which Shelley and I are both in. And I have him there specifically because I was like, a guy with three saves might win this league. This is a full-on redraft, and how many rookies are going to get a save? And I was like, Abner Uribe might get some saves in Milwaukee. His biggest problem was command, and that's been his problem at all levels. He struggles with walks. But if you're just going for the guy with the best stuff, the wipeout, filthy, I'm a closer stuff, it looks like Abner Uribe to me. And so as much as I like Yoel Piamps, and I have him in a handful of places, he's who I took in Clark to back up Devin Williams. I'm like, oh, if Devin Williams gets traded, I can have some Piamps, and then I'll have some extra saves. And now that just looks like I covered myself for a really early draft pick that is going to go bust. I think Uribe is special, and I think that if Piamps struggles at all, Uribe gets a shot at that job.
All right. Well, Shelley, we already heard that you're Piamps over Uribe, but do you want to rebut this by saying you're so far off Uribe that you take Trevor McGill instead too, or no?
No, I'm still going to stick with Piamps. I mean, I honestly hope that I'm wrong because I do agree with Sarah that Uribe is so much more exciting to watch than Piamps. I'm just banking on Milwaukee. Again, we have like a totally new manager. So maybe he can talk to the front office, but I don't know. Well, we also have a new front office because we have, he went to the Mets, their old GM.
Stearns. Yeah.
Stearns. Thank you. Yeah. So we have like a totally new thing in Milwaukee. So we have no idea, I guess, what they're going to do. I'm just going to go with, it just seems that most teams go this particular route. They go with the older guy versus the young hot guy. So that's where I'm going to stick.
All right, Sarah, have you been convinced by that 1 minute, or you're still sticking on Uribe? And would you go McGill or in second or no?
You know, I looked at McGill pretty closely. What was I writing? I was writing a piece the other day, and I was really impressed with what he did last year. The K rate last year was out of this world, and it really did look like he had a breakout campaign. The thing that I came down to, though, at the end of the day was that I just think that Piamps and Uribe have more of an inside track here. I think that McGill kind of got used more in like that seventh inning role last season. And, he might bump up to be in like an eighth inning role. But the jump from like you're high leverage, but you're not really the eighth inning guy or the ninth inning guy to like, no, you're the guy seems pretty big to me. And I think that it's a shorter leap for both Uribe and Piamps. So I like both of them more. I feel like I should concede that when I was taking the guy who I thought would get the extra saves after Devin Williams got traded, it was always Piamps. All draft season long, I would like take Devin Williams and whatever round Devin Williams was going. And then the second to third to last pick, I would take Joel Piamps and feel sneaky like I was going to get 15 extra saves from that somehow, if somehow I could save him on my bench until Milwaukee traded him. I no longer feel sneaky about that. I do feel like I covered myself for not having a closer for a while.
Making your cat happy is a number one priority. Priority number two is keeping a clean litter box. Fresh Step Outstretch litter helps you do both. Fresh Step Outstretch litter traps waste at the surface with less crumbles and absorbs more waste and odor compared to Fresh Step Multicat. Find Fresh Step Outstretch litter at a store near you today. Fresh Step is a registered trademark of the Clorox Pet Products Company. Certain trademarks used under license from the Procter & Gamble Company or its affiliates.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruit and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Requires Gemini device and additional paid subscriptions to watch Netflix and other third-party apps. Terms and restrictions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now I've been taking Uribe after Pyance goes and feeling like, well, maybe I'll get some extra saves that way. But this could wind up being a committee for precisely the reason Shelly said, which is that the brewers are generally pretty cheap. And one way to keep down the prices on all three of these arms is to make sure they each only have like 10 saves.
Yep, could be a committee and probably only a half year committee too, which is why I was curious whether or not either of you would take the, you know, and I'm just skipping all of these guys position, but you didn't, which is good to hear, I think. But it'll probably be Trevor McGill, I think, after all this, given that we're stumping for the two others, but we'll find out.
We will find out. Well, that's actually a great idea. We should revisit some of these debates and like see where we were right and wrong. Because one of the advantages to the show format over some of like, and no shade, I love everybody's fantasy baseball podcast. I listen to so many of them. If you listen to the show, I likely listen to you. But honestly, it would be interesting to go back and be like, hey, where were we right? Where were we wrong? Like, which of we have sides? Like, we've laid down our cases on all of these things. We can go back and track them. That might be interesting to do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all how right. Interesting it is depends on whether or not I win, but I agree.
we'll invite you back on and tell you what your winning percentage was, Eric. How about that?
Oh, good. I'll take it.
We always finish the show the same way. A little bit of love it or leave it. One thing from baseball news this week that you are thrilled about or over. Eric, as our guest, you get to kick us off this week.
Yeah, I'm going to go with something not from real baseball news, but from fantasy baseball news. I want to congratulate Nick Pollock on winning the Lore Michaels Award at Tout Wars this past weekend. I think I can be the one to congratulate him because I don't work for Pitcherlist, so I don't sound like I'm sucking up to my boss like you guys. But really great to see Nick win that award. I think the whole room was very happy for him. It's interesting, too. It's an award that started just a few years ago and has so far mostly been awarded to people who have been in fantasy baseball from the beginning, you know, playing since I was born, which means playing since Nick was about 5 years old. Pretty cool to see someone from the under 40 generation get that honor, and no doubt that he deserved it. Really strong analyst and player, but also community builder. And there's not many people who have managed to be all those things, you know, just at this stage in their career. So really, really, really well-deserved, Nick. Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm sure Shelly's going to want to jump in on this one too, but I just have to say I was so excited for Nick. And community builder is right. Like, the Pitcherlist Discord is a really special place. It is so fun to just, like, on a morning where I don't have meetings as I'm getting work done or whatever, to hop into, like, some of those playbacks that he does and hear Nick talk about pitching. I don't think I've ever heard anyone just, like, as excited about pitching and what is going on in an individual like matchup between a batter and pitcher as Nick Pollock. And so I think that enthusiasm is really contagious, and he's done a great job for this industry, and super congrats.
Yeah. I echo everything that Eric and Sarah said, especially Nick's enthusiasm towards pitching. I find it infectious. It makes me want to dig in more, but then he's way too smart and he talks about like stuff that I don't understand. So I'm just like, okay, like IVB. I understand it, but I don't understand it, if you know what I'm saying. But anyway, congratulations, Nick. It's well deserved.
10-10, agree. Shelly, you get our next love it or leave it for this week.
Yeah, so this it's a really exciting, like last weekend, we had like this new series that MLB started. It was their spring breakout, where they put together two fully prospect teams. So let's just say like the Phillies and Braves were playing. So there would be a team of Phillies, like their top prospects, and a team of Braves top prospects. And then they would just, you know, play a game, and it's exciting. It gets, there's played at spring training sites. So people who maybe not are in tuned with, you know, some of like the minor leaguers, they can watch like a really exciting game and start to fall in love with like some of their, you know, future stars of the team. And, you know, they played a couple of the games on MLB Network, which I also think is huge. I just loved it. I mean, obviously I love minor league baseball and prospects in general, but just seeing MLB embrace that and start to showcase it more, I found it phenomenal.
I thought this was so fun, and I was so excited about it. And then the Cubs-White Sox game got rained out in Arizona, of all places. And I was like, how do you get rained out in Arizona? And they're not making it up. So the Cubs and White Sox prospects did not get their moment to shine, which was a super bummer, because Cade Horton was supposed to pitch that day. And if y'all like pitching prospects, you already know who Cade Horton is, but that slider is also supposed to be filthy. And I was so excited to see it. Anyway, I'll have to wait until next year. I think this is a great idea. MLB should do more of this. One of the things that has grated me more than anything in the last couple of years was the decision to move the Futures game to Peacock instead of having it on regular cable. Yep. Because I just feel like that was the showcase for minor league talent. And to need to have a certain streaming subscription to get to that showcase always struck me as myopic. And so I agree with you. It was really fun watching those spring breakout games. Yeah, Eric, were you watching?
Yeah, I didn't get to catch, but I was following some of the highlights. Mostly was just trying to figure out why Wyatt Langford wasn't part of it, and whether or not we should read anything into him being there and Jackson, or him not being there and Jackson Holiday, yes, being there, and trying to figure out what this all means. Maybe we'll figure out in a few years how teams are actually using the spring breakout. But either way, it's a very cool idea. Get more prospects in front of the people. We all love prospects.
My love it for this week, and we all loved something this week. I love it when it's optimistic. Sammy Sosa was back in Chicago doing what I can only call Cubs adjacent interviews this week. And for anyone who follows the Cubs, you probably know that Sammy and the Cubs are not on good terms. He was not at any of the World Series festivities. He was one of the like very notable former star players who was not at the parade. He has not been welcomed back to seeing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. He has not done booth interviews or anything like that. He's kind of persona non grata with the front office because of the way he went out, all the steroid stuff and some other things that happened internally. And it was just very cool to see him back in Chicago, like doing the things that he used to do, visiting some local hospitals, really doing some interviews with. And what I mean when I say Cubs adjacent, it wasn't like he went and spoke to the beat writers that you read to get Cubs coverage, but he went and spoke to the sports reporter at the local ABC station who covers all sports, but not necessarily baseball. So it gives him a little bit of cover for political reasons, not hurting the ability of beat writers to cover the team or anything like that. But it also gave fans a chance to welcome Sammy back, which was super cool. He did an interview over at Club 400 with my friend Stuart McVicker, which I thought was incredible and amazing. Stuart is a huge Cubs fan, does a lot of charity work with the Cubs. So really great to see Sammy back doing Cubs adjacent things. I hope this bodes well for Sammy doing actual Cubs things at some point in the future, because honestly, they just need to bury that hatchet. It has been too long. Sammy Sosa hit a ton of home runs for that ball club. And frankly, the home run race between him and Mark McGwire in 1998, I believe, is one of the things that saved the sport after the strike year. So you may hate it, you may not like steroids, but it was about the most fun thing I've ever seen with my own two eyes watching baseball. And Sammy Sosa deserves to be back in the fold. Takeaways for this week. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. What are you working on these days? Where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, I'm at rotowire.com. Got articles every week. MLB Barometer kicking off soon. Bunch of spring training stuff. You can also listen to me on the radio. I host our MLB Network radio show on Saturday evenings, and I'm one of our hosts on the SiriusXM Fantasy Channel. I'm on there on Friday and Saturday around lunchtime, and you also might be able to hear me on the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball podcast more often this season. Looking forward to that.
Awesome. That is one of the many podcasts I listen to. Look forward to listening to you there. Shelly, what are you working on? Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at ShellyV_643. I'm just, you know, writing a weekly article over at RotoWorlds, doing a couple new shifts here and there, but I don't know, kind of laying low, trying to enjoy some spring training baseball before everything gets hectic with all the fab. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing.
We're going to have some fab debates in our near future. That is wild. Yeah, baseball is like 9 days away. Well, like the actual season is like 9 days away. Actual baseball is like 12 hours away as we're recording this. By the time you listen to it, it will have happened. The season will have started, which is incredible. And I'm so excited. You can find my baseball takes at BCB_Sarah. You can find my fantasy writing at Baseball HQ, obviously, my podcasting here at Pitcherless. And if you want some Cubs heavy content, I've got that at BleedCubbyBlue.com. I have a piece out today looking at the battle for the fifth starter spot in the Cubs rotation. And if you made it this far, I'll just tell you, I think Drew Smyly has that job to start off the season. And Drew Smyly was off to a hot start last year. So you could do worse with your last pick in a draft than picking up Drew Smyly and seeing what he can do in the cold weather in Chicago. But there will be baseball in that cold weather in Chicago, and we'll be talking about all of it here. Until next time.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruit and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Requires Gemini device and additional paid subscriptions to watch Netflix and other third-party apps. Terms and restrictions apply.